Welcome. Today is Tuesday, October the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the second presidential debate is being called the ugliest ever.
Secretary Clinton, does Mr. Trump have the discipline to be a good leader?
No.
I'm shocked to hear that.
What the candidate's body language says about how they were feeling. It's Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the U.S. Why this is personal. Also ahead, we are talking about all kinds of stuff. It's all on today's International Edition. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump faced off in a tense debate on Sunday in St. Louis, Missouri, for the second of three presidential debates. This one was held amid a growing chorus of Republicans who want Donald Trump to quit the race after the release of a videotape in which he made offensive remarks about women. But as VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports, Trump was aggressive from the start.
The tension was evident from the start as the candidates dispensed with the traditional opening handshake. Trump sought to apologize for vulgar references to women on an 11-year-old videotape.
Yes, I'm very embarrassed by it. I hate it, but it's locker room talk, and it's one of those things.
Clinton cited the tape as evidence that Trump is not fit to be president, and the latest in a long list of insulting comments targeting women, Latinos, and Muslims.
So this is who Donald Trump is, and the question for us, the question our country must answer, is that this is not who we are.
Trump kept on the attack throughout the debate, calling Clinton a liar and, at one point, the devil. He also criticized her again for her use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State.
But if I win, I am going to instruct my Attorney General to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation, because there has never been so many lies.
Everything he just said is absolutely false, but I'm not surprised.
Really?
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
Clinton hammered away at Trump's proposed Muslim ban, while Trump said his plan had changed.
We are not at war with Islam, and it is a mistake, and it plays into the hands of the terrorists to act as though we are.
It's called extreme vetting. We are going to areas like Syria, where they're coming in by the tens of thousands because of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
And the two also clashed over Syria and Russia, with Clinton alleging that Russia favors Trump.
Russia has decided that it's all in Syria. And they've also decided who they want to see become president of the United States, too, and it's not me.
I don't know, Putin. I think it would be great if we got along with Russia, because we could fight ISIS together, as an example.
The only positive note came at the end, when a voter asked the candidates to say something nice about each other, which they did.
His children are incredibly able and devoted, and I think that says a lot about Donald.
I will say this about Hillary. She doesn't quit. She doesn't give up. I respect that.
Clinton and Trump meet for a third and final debate in Las Vegas on October 19th. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about what the candidate's body language says during the debate. I talked about it with CEO of the Body Language Institute, Janine Driver. Janine, the debate started pretty cold when the two didn't shake hands.
Well, I wasn't surprised there was no handshake. You know, after Trump brought out the four women just before the debate, I was expecting that Hillary Clinton would not shake his hand, or at least not offer to shake his hand. Perhaps she would have if he had outstretched his hand. If you look at that, Donald Trump, almost as he's walking towards Hillary when he walks out, almost takes a second, like a back step, and he looks at Hillary an extra 2 seconds after she looks away. So I think he would have shaken her hand if she had initiated it. So you kind of see that awkwardness for like a 3 second beat.
And then as the debate progressed, it looked like Donald Trump was doing a lot of pacing.
Yeah, he was pacing quite a bit, right? He doesn't want to sit down for whatever reason. He's not used to not calling the shots. He's not used to waiting his turn. He's not used to someone standing in front of him.
What do you think his body language said about how he was feeling?
That particular movement where he was standing behind Hillary Clinton, you saw him holding onto his stool. I was actually more concerned when he went from behind her further back to the back of the stage and started pacing. That's a pre-assault indicator, and it is. And a pre-assault indicator is this kind of seesawing stance, kind of walking back and forth. I said this morning on CNN. What I didn't get to say is we're always looking before a real assault. There's multiple clusters of nonverbal tells. So this was one of several that we would see before an assault. I was not saying Donald Trump's about to smash Hillary in the face. Other than that, Trump, we saw leaking contempt, which is more superiority, which is typical Trump. He also pointed, I think this is the Trump, the people who love Trump, this is your guy. This is who he showed up. He even said at the end, hey, Hillary, what I like best about you is you're a fighter, you don't give up, son. So I think he had his pluses and minuses, and I think Hillary, same thing. She had her strengths and weaknesses. Hillary's a pointer, just like Trump, but we didn't see her pointing in the first debate or last night. And this is interesting because this is coached. She worked at this, without a doubt worked on this. She didn't point, and this is crucial because people who say she's not likable, it'll come from her chin up, which it was up on both debates, and the combo of that chin up and the pointing, it's over the top. We didn't see the pointing. I think that her fake smile last night hurt her more than the first debate. Because the first debate, she had that perma-smile the whole time. So people like me, who are trained in micro-expressions and body language, it makes it more of a challenge for us to spot where Trump is kind of shaking her boat if she's got that fake smile. It's like a poker face. But last night, that fake smile only came when he rattled her cage.
Well, you know, you were talking about Donald Trump walking behind Hillary Clinton. I almost felt a little uncomfortable when she was talking. He was almost hovering, standing behind her. It seemed like there was a personal space issue.
So that's my question to everybody. So what should he have done in that moment? She is on his side of the stage. This is what I'm saying, like when this was probably not practiced by either camp. Because what should she have done differently? What could he have done differently? She's literally standing 2 feet next to his chair. Should he scoot behind her and just sit down? Should he walk over to her side of the stage? People are talking about, well, he was doing that to intimidate her. Yeah, that's what he was doing. But yeah, without a doubt, it was intimidating. Listen, I said on CNN this morning, I was holding my chair, too. I was anxious.
Did she handle that well?
I thought she handled that excellent. Quite frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if it was not a strategy a little bit planned on her team and her camp. Because if she's standing in front of Trump on his side, how is he going to interrupt her? It would have been really awkward. The camera was on her. The audience is on her. The eyes are on her. It makes Hillary look like she was talking to the audience. They asked a question. And so Trump is the one that kind of looks awkward.
It's interesting because they didn't shake hands at the beginning, but they did at the end.
Yes, and that was a Trump initiation, right? So a couple things happened here. Number one, in the first debate, we saw Hillary Clinton come out. She walked towards Trump, and she extended her hand. She was on Trump's territory, like his side of the stage. That actually was a win for Trump in the first debate. The close of the second debate was a win for Hillary Clinton. Trump walked to her side of the stage. She stood right in front of her lectern. He walked there. He extended his hand. She shook. So he's giving her a power right there at the end. Plus, he had just sung her praises, saying she's a woman that's not going to give up. But he gets a little bit of his power back when he takes his left hand and holds her elbow while he's shaking. That's like, hey, I'll give it to you, some power here, but not all of it.
Body language expert Janine Driver, thanks so much. Let's check in now with G. Abby Lee for what's been trending on social media regarding Monday night's debate. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
So you mentioned that people are talking about someone who asked a question at the town hall. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Sure. It looks like this person gave a lot of people Halloween costume ideas. In fact, some media outlets are going as far as saying he's a real winner of the second debate. His name is Kenneth Bone, and he asked a question about energy. And he became an instant internet sensation with his earnest manner and down-to-earth outfit.
Really? What are people saying about him specifically?
Well, mostly about his sweater. So he wore a red cable-knit zip-up sweater. Mm-hmm. Nothing special there, right?
No.
But that specific sweater is now sold out on Amazon for sizes small to extra large for men.
Wow.
But since Twitter users are sharing updated info about its availability at various stores, you can turn to social media for that. It's funny, though, that the red sweater was actually his plan B. He wanted to wear an olive suit, but in an interview Monday morning, he said he split his pants on the way over to the debate. He said he just got bigger.
Oh.
And that candidness is making people like him even more. Here's an example from Chicago-based reporter Scott Smith. He tweeted, "Let's all try to be a little like Ken Bone today. Humble, wise, enjoying the hell out of a sweater."
That's great. What else is trending?
Lori, Ken Bone's sweater is not the only outfit at the venue that caught people's attention. Many Twitter users are also talking about Donald Trump's wife, Melania Trump's choice of her blouse. The pink Gucci blouse she wore has a bow that's called in the fashion industry as a bow with a word Trump used in the leaked tape. It's interesting to observe that Clinton supporters are tweeting that she must be trolling her husband, and Trump supporters are saying, actually, she's targeting the Clintons.
Wow.
Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Islamic State confirms the death of a senior leader. France says Russia could face war crimes over Aleppo. Michelle Obama's legacy is rooted in the White House garden. And Samsung halts the production and sales of the Note 7. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, in Haiti, hundreds of thousands are in need of immediate humanitarian assistance in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. The official death toll exceeds 300, but could go higher as areas remain difficult to reach. The catastrophic damage was made worse because the impoverished country is still recovering from a devastating earthquake in 2010. Thousands were still living in flimsy shelters. Paul Hassi, National Director for the humanitarian agency World Vision in Port-au-Prince, tells VOA's Victor Beatty virtually nothing in Haiti's southwest was spared.
Many of our staff, you know, they live through the earthquake, and yet they're almost speechless when they see what the destruction is.
The full force of the Category 4 storm glanced by Haiti, but I think the southwestern tip was the hardest hit.
In those areas, the destruction is, it's awe-striking. 80 to 90% of those areas are just flattened. I mean, the pictures that we're seeing and the assessments that I've seen, and trees down on top of houses, families without their homes, it's just sewage from the latrines and other things are coming out. So that whole area there is devastated. Some other hard hits are areas are like Lago Nav, the island in the middle. The western side took a really hard blow. 50% of the houses are destroyed there as well. And then the northwest as well, that's not getting a lot of attention, but what we're hearing from our partners that work there is it's also just extremely hard hit.
There's a quote from the UN humanitarian coordinator in Haiti. He said of the 1.3 million people in southern Haiti, with a poverty rate of 60 to 70%, we're not far from having 1 million people who are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance.
That's been our estimate. It's been a little over a million people, not just in the south, but in some of the other hard hit areas. World Vision has a very strong presence in Latinov, and we've seen just those areas be hit really hard as well. 50% of the people don't have a home anymore. In the south, again, just so many people are out of the house. They're in shelters or they're out in the open. So World Vision is rushing to get tarps and temporary supplies, non-food items. You know, we're also getting them just a place so that they can stay dry. We're still in the rainy season, so it's raining at night. These are just some of the basic needs of people. We're already starting to mobilize food to these populations as well.
John, there are reports of several cases of cholera.
This is our biggest concern in the medium and long term. Even in the short term, it's just cholera is going to be one of the biggest issues just because so many of the latrines and the sewage is in the streets and people just don't have clean water. Their wells have been destroyed. They've been flooded. We very much expect cholera to resurface.
How long do you expect the recovery to take? Because that country survived a devastating earthquake back in 2010 and people were still living in tent cities at that time.
We're planning for probably about a 6-month response time in the sense that, you know, initially we're just trying to keep people alive. We're trying to make sure that they have enough food, that they have clean water. So going to very quickly transition into restoring their food crops. You know, that mean, like 80 to 90% of these crops have been destroyed. So helping them start replanting their beans and the corn and other things in the coming weeks. The growing season starts in a few weeks, and that's going to take a little while. And then restoring people's homes, getting them roofs back on their homes, helping them, restore some of their basic, the needs of cooking supplies, etc. These are also some of the things that we'll be doing, and that's why it'll take 3 to 6 months to do that.
Well, the U.S. military has been delivering food and medicine to Haiti, as well as heavy lift helicopters, bulldozers, water delivery vehicles, and mobile operating rooms. The International Red Cross has also issued an emergency appeal for donations for Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. In the U.S., hundreds of thousands remain without power after the hurricane, and the situation could worsen as rivers continue to crest. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley.
The flooding from the rivers has been unfortunate, and what we are seeing is just a lot of damage. Most first floors are gone, if not homes altogether. We saw cars lost, impassable roads.
Matthew was the most powerful storm to hit the United States coast in nearly a decade, and one of the longest lasting major hurricanes on record. Well, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the United States, and for me, it is a reminder of how the disease came into my life several years ago. I was diagnosed first in April of 2012 and then again 10 months later. It's a terrifying thing to hear your doctor say you have breast cancer. The first thing you think of is that you're going to die, and certainly the treatment can be very traumatic in itself. Thankfully, I am here to talk about it, and I hope others will find comfort in knowing they are not alone and there's life beyond what may seem at the time like a death sentence. So throughout the month, we'll be talking to a number of people on the topic. Today, joining me, Fran Visco, president and one of the founders of the National Breast Cancer Coalition. Thank you so much for being here. I know you yourself are a survivor. First, talk about how your organization started.
We started because a group of women came together and wanted to do for breast cancer what the AIDS activists had done for AIDS. We wanted to become, political activists around the issue. We wanted to change the scientific community, and we wanted to push for meaningful funding and a meaningful role for advocates.
So what exactly is the goal now?
Well, the mission is to end breast cancer, and it always has been. And we've had various campaigns over the years to get there. And our most recent campaign is Breast Cancer Deadline 2020, where we are working very hard to know how to end breast cancer. And we want to know that by January 2020.
Do you feel like you'll be able to reach the goal?
I think we will reach the goal. I think we will know how to end breast cancer by then. We'll have to then fight to get what we know implemented. But I think we'll be successful with that, too.
It seems like it's become somewhat of an epidemic.
Well, breast cancer, I think, is an epidemic. One of the problems with breast cancer, of course, is that we have screening in the United States and in some other countries, so that sort of artificially increases the incidence of breast cancer because you're finding stage zero breast cancer and you're finding breast cancer, quote unquote, that will never kill anyone. So what we really need to worry about is lethal breast cancer. And so one of the reasons that the coalition began and why we continue is because we want to figure out how can we stop people from getting breast cancer to begin with, and how can we stop people from dying of it. This being October is that we've unfortunately over the years, people have made breast cancer pink and pretty. And it isn't. And it is a lethal disease. And 40,000 women will die in this country alone of breast cancer, over 500,000 worldwide. And the WHO estimates that number will be over 800,000 by 2030 if we continue along the same pace. So I think people have this false sense that we're making great progress in breast cancer, and we haven't. And that's why we really need to focus on the deadline. We need to bring back urgency to the issue. And we need to focus on saving lives.
Right. I know anyone, certainly myself as a survivor, wouldn't feel that a pretty pink ribbon would describe my experience.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I was diagnosed 27 years ago, and I would be treated the exact same way today as I was treated 27 years ago.
Hmm.
So that gives you a sense of the progress we've made also.
So when we hear all these things about lots of progress is being made and people's lives are being extended, is that inaccurate?
Well, I think we have reduced the mortality rate in breast cancer in this country. It's been reduced at the rate of 1.9% a year for a number of years now, but that number is not accelerating. So if you were making progress, you would think that would increase, and it isn't. So I think we're seeing the benefit of decades ago, starting with chemotherapy and different kinds of treatment for breast cancer. But we really haven't made significant progress. And even if we have extended life, which I believe we have, and I hope that is the case, still more than 40,000 women will die this year of breast cancer.
That's Fran Visco, president and one of the founders of the National Breast Cancer Coalition. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On November 8th, American voters will choose their next president. We'll provide you with the latest updates. Will it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Will third-party candidates like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein have an impact on the final outcome? What does that mean for Americans and the world? It's all here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, there was a very big event over the weekend, and we're not talking about the presidential debate. Craft beer lovers from across the country flocked to Denver, Colorado to attend the Great American Beer Fest, one of the biggest beer festivals in the world. I caught up with freelance journalist Chris Morris, who was there.
Well, the craft beer industry is really, in the larger beer sense, is still pretty small. It only takes about 10% of the market. But what you're looking at here is these are the most passionate beer drinkers around. They're the ones who don't hesitate to pay $15, $20 for a four or a six-pack, sometimes as much as $20, $50, even $60 for a single bottle of beer if it's rare. These are the people that the craft brewers are really trying to reach, and they're trying to keep them engaged. And ultimately, this is the base that is spending all the money on craft beer.
Chris, how big of a deal is this?
This is actually probably the biggest beer event in the United States. There are a lot of local and regional beer festivals, but the Great American Beer Festival is the Mac Daddy of them all. You're looking at tickets that sell out within an hour, and this is for four different sessions over the course of 3 days. This is Mecca for the craft beer lovers.
So people come to this event and they drink beer, I take it.
they drink a lot of beer, actually. Yeah, but you drink a lot of beer a little bit at a time. You only get 1 ounce pours from the different breweries there. So they do push responsibility, and there's a lot of water around. The ideal ratio for people who come here is have one or two samples and then fill your cup up with water and bring down your blood alcohol content.
Who are some of the big names, and what are some of the most popular beers there that are trying to strut their stuff?
Well, I think what you're seeing here is that some of the largest brewers, some of the biggest cult brewers, Russian River, which makes Pliny the Elder, there is Dogfish Head, which has not only its usual standards like Dogfish Head 120, but they're introducing a new beer this year. Cigar City out of Tampa is here. They've got long lines. There's a brewer out of Texas called Jester King. They poured all of their beer within the first hour of pouring the first night. So if you're looking for what's called a whale, which is one of the very rare craft beers, you got to get here early and you got to be willing to stand in line.
Wow, that's crazy.
I mean, there are people dressed up here in lederhosen, and I think I saw someone in a Mario costume. It's a bit of madness.
How big of a deal is beer in the U.S.?
It's a huge deal. I mean, it's not quite on the level of wine right now. The thing that you have to think of is beer is kind of a wide category. There is macro beer, which is from Budweiser and MillerCoors, which is all one company these days. And there's this craft beer scene. And the craft beer is really what's kind of igniting passion among beer drinkers. That's what has the hoppier taste. They're doing some of the unusual stuff, like a sour peach ale. But ultimately, it's a growing category, and it's something that the food and beverage industry is very excited about.
All right. Journalist Chris Morris, who writes for Fortune and Yahoo.com, among others, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that is going to do it for this edition of today's International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On October 12, 1492, three Spanish ships under the leadership of Christopher Columbus landed on an island in what is today the Bahamas. The anniversary of that event, observed annually in the United States as Columbus Day, initiated a vast global exchange of foods, animals, plants, peoples, and diseases that transformed the world, known today as the Columbian Exchange. For that reason, 1492 is considered by most historians to be the most significant year in modern world history. World population has increased more than four times since 1492, doubling between 1650 and 1850. Although a number of contributing factors are responsible for such enormous growth, clearly the most significant is an increased and improved food supply. The addition to the food supply of Native American food plants such as maize, potato, tomato, peanuts, manioc, pineapple, peppers, and cocoa beans was the most significant factor. The potato became the most important food source for the poor in Central and Northern Europe. Maize and manioc were introduced to Africa in the 16th century and replaced traditional African crops as the continent's most important staple food crops. The introduction to China of New World food crops, in particular potatoes, corn, and peanuts, resulted in a population boom between 1500 and 1650. By the 18th century, over one-third of the world's population lived in China. The Columbian Exchange was global, introducing new foods to every corner of the world. Before 1492, there were no oranges in Florida, no bananas in Ecuador, no paprika in Hungary. The exchange brought tomatoes to Italy, coffee to Colombia and Indonesia, pineapples to Hawaii, rubber trees to Africa, chili peppers to Thailand, China, and India, and chocolate to Switzerland. The landfall of the three small ships on an island in the Bahamas brought about unprecedented change in the course of history. It shaped the future of humankind for centuries to come, not just because of the discovery of a new continent, but because it brought about regular contact between the Earth's hemispheres, engendering trade, allowing for an exchange of ideas, and creating connections and encounters between cultures. In 1492, the peoples of the world began to come together as a global society, and that is good for all peoples.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
It's